This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 28 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. We have an absolute legend of the NFL as a guest today. He's a man who was a Super Bowl winner. He was one of the very best defensive backs in NFL history. He was on the 75th anniversary team. He was on the 100th anniversary team. He was a Hall of Famer. It's Rod Woodson. And I remember growing up watching Rod play. Incredible player. Got to work with him around one of the London games a few years back. We reconnected this week. And before we got under the skin of Rod's NFL career and his life in football, we started our conversation discussing the recent announcement that Rod Woodson had been named as an ambassador for the London Olympians and how that came to be.
Well, I met Coach Turek, about 8 months ago, if not a little longer. And then we just started talking, and you know, our mindset of sharing the knowledge, that's one of his hashtags that he loves to use. And that's something that we use all the time around here. Is that, you know, anytime you have the ability to gain knowledge and attain that knowledge, you need to share it, and you need to share it with the next generation. But meeting him and talking to him, our ideas, our thoughts about football are very similar. And when he offered me the opportunity to be the ambassador for the London Olympians. You know, first of all, it was a huge honor for me because I won American football, and football has been good to me in my career. I've been very fortunate enough to play with four iconic teams, 17 years in the National Football League, learned a lot, but also know that American football is played outside of the U.S. It's played outside the NFL. And you know, I've known that for quite a while. I didn't know how deep it ran, not only in the UK, but just around the world. I'm learning that out. And being a part of the London Olympians is just shows how entrenched American football is across the globe.
And what about your work with Hope Through Football? Tell me a little bit about that so we can learn about that.
Well, Hope Through Football is a nonprofit foundation that I started probably a little over a year ago. When I played, I had a foundation called Woodson Charities that I did nonprofit work, and I normally did just football camps in my hometown with all the kids in my hometown. But starting Hope Through Football is really that, and you know, it stands for helping our youth practice excellence through football. And, you know, football's given me everything I have in my life. I didn't apply myself to the best of my ability as a student athlete growing up. So, you know, could I went to college, you know, outside of, you know, sports? Maybe, but it would have been tough. Because my family, we didn't have a lot of money. If I didn't get an academic scholarship or athletic scholarship, I probably wouldn't have went. I probably would have been like my oldest brother and went to the military. But football's been good to me, and I want to give back to that. And so what we started is, obviously the pandemic is going on right now, but once it's over, we're going to have in-person clinics. We'll have mini combines inside of that. We'll have a speed clinic inside of that. We'll have a social media inside of that. We'll have recruiting solutions. So we'll have a recruiter that comes with us to recruits for colleges throughout the U.S. And then, you know, the biggest thing, though, is that everybody who works with it has played in the National Football League or coached in the National Football League. Those are the only people who are allowed to coach outside of our ghost coaches. So we'll let some coach. So if we come to the U.K., we'll have six or so ghost coaches who can follow the coaches in the position meetings throughout the 2.5 days that we will do it. But, you know, the biggest thing is just, you know, we want is to kind of plant a seed that they are special athletes. Football can change your life, but it can change you even if you don't play in the National Football League, it can change you just as a man. It can help you be a better person, a better human being, a better brother, a better son. And if we can find that out, if we can plant that seed, then we win. And we make all the communities, not just here locally, but abroad. And that's our goal. That's our mission. We would also, my dream is to see the NFL very similar to the NBA, where they have all the different national flags can be flown if they were prior to the games. And I think we're getting closer. I think American football is growing to the point where it is getting bigger. It is growing to the point where more countries or people who have been born out of the U.S. will be drafted in the National Football League.
So let's get into the heart of Rod's story in the NFL then. As we touched upon in our introduction, he is a Super Bowl winning cornerback who moved on to safety and enjoyed a career that spanned three decades with the Pittsburgh Steelers, San Francisco 49ers, Baltimore Ravens, and the Raiders. But before all that, a young Rod Woodson had to navigate life with two older brothers.
Football's always been a part of my life. I mean, I'm the youngest of three boys, and you know, I started playing football because my brothers played and I wanted to be around my brothers. You know, we're all very close in age. I was the youngest, so they always picked on me. So, you know, but as I even got picked on, I still wanted to be around them. And when they started playing, I wanted to play. So I started playing when I was 9 years old for the PAL League, our police athletic league, for the PAL Raiders. And the one thing that I really loved about the PAL Raiders is our coach, his name was Dave Rohde. We're still great friends, but he made the game fun for me as a kid. I didn't really understand football at that point, but I know it was fun being around a bunch of other kids, and we all got to like scream and holler and hit each other and kind of, you know, tackle each other and kind of have fun with each other. But we learned a lot, and Dave made it fun. So to me, football's always been a part of that. We always had little football uniforms. You know, obviously back in the day, we didn't have direct TV or cable. We only had three channels. So, you know, we got to watch certain games on Sundays, but it was all the local games. You know, so it'd be the Cleveland Browns or the Chicago Bears or the Cincinnati Bengals. One of those teams are always on.
Have you ever stopped to think that you started your football career with the Raiders and ended it as a player with the Raiders?
No. I mean, that was my, you know, once I realized I could, you know, I was getting better at football and I got into the league. You know, even though I played for the Pittsburgh Steelers, are an awesome organization. The Rooney family is tremendous. I bleed black and gold, always have, always will. But the Raiders have been my childhood team. I had, you know, I had Lester Hayes poster in my room when he had his, you know, his hair, his helmet on. He had to stick him. He had to stick him with the tape all the way up to his elbow. And he had the towel draped down to the ground and he was in his stance like that. I had that in my room. So when I realized I maybe had the opportunity, and that was after I played with Baltimore, we won our Super Bowl the following year after 2001, I went to the Pro Bowl and Willie Brown and Al Davis were standing on the field. And I ran by them and said, I'm going to be a free agent. And I kept on running. And I kept running. And a week after, well, whenever free agent started, probably 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from Al Davis. And I became a Raider. It was kind of my bucket list checkmark for my teams.
Yes. Started with the Pee Wee League Raiders and finished with the NFL's Raiders. Brilliant. Let's talk about your career in the NFL then. We'll go through some of the teams and some of the big moments. But first of all, big question, 17 years in the NFL at such a high level. How do you think you lasted at such a high level? Is it purely skill or there must be so many more things to it than just talent alone?
Yeah, well, Chuck Noll, the great Chuck Noll, told me after I got into the building that talent is nothing. Everybody has talent. And then I really started thinking about it. I'm like, I guess so. You know, you really don't know me. you know, I am fast. I'm a decent size for my position, being 6'1", 205 pounds as a corner. That's pretty big. But he was like, you know, everybody has some type of talent. Everybody has a skill set. That's why we draft them. He said, but the great players play the game 2-to-1 mental to physical. And when he said it, I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, it really didn't still register with me because I was still young. I mean, I was young, dumb, just thought I could do everything. But he, after the third year, Tony Dungy left us, who was a great coach for me. And a guy named Rod Russ came in, and Rod challenged me as an athlete to be more than just an athlete. He said the exact same thing that Chuck Noll told me 3 years prior. He said, you need to learn this game mentally. And I wasn't married. I had no obligations in the off season. This was an off season. I'm like, well, teach me. And he was like, all right, well, you come in my office every day and we'll just talk football. And I went in there, and the first day he asked me, how many formations can offense get into? And I'm like, 700? I don't know. He was like, no, five. Simplify it to a simplest form. And I stayed in the room with him for probably 5 weeks, and the green light clicked on. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. This is all they do? And it's really the same today. I mean, everybody's running the run and shoot, and what Buffalo Bill used to do, the K-gun, everybody's doing that with the addition of the RPO, which is new.
So before you got to that point where the light came on, you heard your name called in the draft. It was interesting. I read that Chuck Noll didn't even ask Tony Dungy to provide a scouting report on you because the Steelers didn't think you would be there with the 10th overall pick. Did you expect to be there? Or were you kind of, did you have that chip on your shoulder when you arrived in Pittsburgh? Tell me about that process.
Yeah, I didn't really have a chip on my shoulder. I mean, everybody kept telling me I was going to be a top five pick. And that was the first year that you got to, so remember back then we had Plan B for agency, and the Cleveland Browns and the San Diego Chargers traded Chip Banks. And that was the first time that ever happened in the history of the Plan B free agency. And then the Cleveland Browns drafted Junkins. He's a linebacker from Duke. And then it kind of threw the board off. And I guess that's what everybody looks at. They look at the board, and it kind of fell down. I never even talked to the Steelers. I mean, I had no idea if the Steelers were even looking at me.
Wow.
But I did talk to these New Orleans Saints. And the New Orleans Saints did call me. They had the number 11th pick. And they called me and said, if you're there at 11, we're taking you. And I think the number 9th, the team was up on the podium getting ready to make their call. And they said, if you're there at 11, we're taking you. And luckily for me, I went to the Steelers because Tony taught me a great deal. Chuck Noll taught me a great deal. But the Rooney family taught me a great deal.
Yeah, I was just going to – Chuck Noll, Tony Dungy, later on Bill Cowher. I mean – player to learn from those kinds of people. I mean, they're giants of the coaching industry. It must have been wonderful for a player.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I needed, when I first came in the league, I needed Tony Dungy because I'm not a person that you yell at. You know, I don't need, you know, my coach is yelling at me, I'm done talking to him. I won't even listen to him. I'll block him out. But Tony just loved on you and loved on you and loved on you and loved. That's his template. He gives you the belief factor that you can do anything. So I needed Tony when I first came in the league. After Tony, then I really needed Rod Russ because really, I didn't tell you the whole story about Rod, but we did an indoor walkthrough. Rod was talking. I was talking in the background. Rod cussed me out. I mean, just gave it to me. And then he challenged me as a man. So I needed Rod after Tony. And Rod was a great defensive-minded coach. Mm. And then, you know, after Rod and Chuck Noll retired, Rod left the Steelers. And then we got Bill Cowher and Dom Capers and Dick LeBeau. And, and even though I love Bill Cowher, but Dick LeBeau was my guy. You know, he was our defensive coordinator. I mean, excuse me, our defensive back coach, you know. Dom Capers was a defense coordinator, but Dick just allowed us to be us. And that's what he said. I'm going to let you bring your own uniqueness into our system. Just go have fun. Because when you have fun, you play so much better and you play faster. We're like, Yeah, I guess so. That is true. I mean, it was a simple statement. But, you know, my 10 years in Pittsburgh, I had so much knowledge just given to me from, you know, not only Chuck Knoll, but you got to remember that Mean Joe Green was our defensive line coach.
Wow.
You know, so he was there. And, you know, I got to talk to Donnie Shell was there still. Mike Webster was still there. John Stallworth was still there. So I got to play with those Hall of Famers. And, you know, they told me about the culture they built prior to us coming there. So just coming into a culture like that in a place like that, it really helped me. It solidified my knowledge of the game. And it allowed me to play my 17 years because as you get older and a little slower, your reflexes are not as quick. You need to understand the game and so you can still play fast. And that they really helped me.
So we need to set the scene for this next part of Rod's story. It's the 3rd of September, 1995, and Rod has just torn his ACL, which for most people would rule them out for the entire season. We wouldn't expect to see a player back in action until a year later after suffering such a serious injury. But come the end of January and that season's Super Bowl, just 19 weeks after his injury, Rod was playing for the Steelers, breaking up passes thrown to Dallas Cowboys' Michael Irvin. The Steelers would lose Super Bowl 30 to the Cowboys, but on a personal level, Rod must have felt proud of the effort. Just how did he go from that injury to featuring in a Super Bowl so quickly?
Well, first, I had an open-minded coach in Bill Cowher. That's the first thing. You know, the injury occurred, and then that Monday we come back, we're sitting with the doctors, and the doctor's just like, it's going to be 4 to 6 months recovery. And he's still talking, the doctor is, I'm in my head like calculating 4 to 6 months. Oh, that's playoffs. I can get back, coach. I said, just like that, I said, I can get back. You leave the spot open for me, I'll get back and I'm going to play. We're good enough to get back. And we should have went the year before, but we lost to San Diego on that little last minute play. I knew we were good enough. And I just couldn't believe that Bill Cowher gave me that opportunity. Now, what really helped me is that a guy named Carnell Lake was so athletic that he can go from outside linebacker to strong safety to cornerback in the National Football League and hold up on his own extremely well and played. I mean, he balled out that year at the cornerback position and nobody else got hurt in the secondary. And that was the key. If anybody else would have got hurt, they would have had to put me on IR. I would have been done. But having Bill Cowher, having an open mind and having, you know, Carnell Lake being able to go from strong safety to play corner, and he's never played out there before and play as well as he did and nobody else get hurt, was a blessing.
It was an incredible comeback. It really was. When you got to be one of the top corners in the NFL, before you moved to safety, you're kind of out there on an island. We know what that position, everything it entails. Were there any wide receivers that still scared you though?
Nobody really scared. I mean, got to remember also, you know, when I didn't play corner in high school. So when I played Little League, from Little League to high school to college, I was a safety. Then I ran my 40 at the combine. They're like, oh, you're going to play corner. You know, there's not too many 4.28 safeties. You're going to play corner. So I had to learn the cornerback position. And as I learned the position, nobody ever really – I respected everybody.
But they gave you the biggest challenge then.
But, yeah, the individuals who gave me issues were the smaller, quicker receivers. So, like, the Webster Slaughters back in the day for the Cleveland Browns. I mean, Webster was 5'10"-ish, 5'11"-ish, quick, can get in and out of his breaks. He talked a lot of noise, too, at the same time he's doing it. So all those little receivers like that could give me some issues. The bigger receivers, you know, Givens and
Is it Drew Hill?
Drew Hill, yep. Drew, matter of fact, scored the first touchdown against me in my career playing against him. I didn't know he was that fast. And I didn't realize how fast people were in the National Football League until I got in there and he took off. And I'm like, oh my God, I thought I could catch him. And I reeled him in a little bit, but it was too, you know, I could not run the ball. Touchdown. I'm like, these guys are a lot faster than I thought they were going to be in this league.
We'll be back with more on the Neil Reynolds podcast after this short break.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back to my conversation with Rod Woodson, Hall of Fame defensive back, incredible player in the NFL. Now, before the break, we heard about Rod's career with the Pittsburgh Steelers, where he joined a team that before his time was steeped in defensive tradition. Throughout the 1970s, the Pittsburgh Steelers defense had become known as the Steel Curtain. So he had a lot to live up to. And when Rod eventually moved on to join Baltimore, he took that DNA with him, helping instill a culture that still exists and is spoken about by the Ravens today.
When I was with the Steelers, you know, I unfortunately didn't get to play my whole career there. I left chasing a ring. That's what I was doing when I went to the 49ers. But after that season, and we lost to Green Bay in the championship game, Marvin Lewis called me and he was like, listen, I got a really good young defense. We just don't know how to win yet. I need some leaders. Do you want to come over? I'm like, sure. Hey, let's do it. So I visited. And as soon as I visited, I signed. And exactly what Marvin said, they were talented. Ray Lewis is in his third year. Jonathan Ogden was in his third year. It was a solid defense, but they didn't really take ownership of, and they didn't have the culture yet. So everything that we did in Pittsburgh and everything that was set before me in Pittsburgh, we started doing it in Baltimore. I mean, so on Fridays, we met as a whole defense. No defensive coaches were in the room, all players. So we took ownership of what we did. We challenged each other to do everything the right way, to be on time. And the one thing that really helped us is Brian Billick coming as the head coach really challenged us as players too, as men. Like, he wasn't going to have bed check. He was like, you guys are grown men. You guys are old as I am. And if I got to bed check you guys, then you really don't want it. And if you don't want it, you're not going to be here. So he helped mold that direction. And now what you see, you know, Ray, you know, after we did it for the 4 years, and then Ray, I leave, and then Ray just kept it up and made it to a, took it to another level. But that's why you see when you walk outside of their tunnel on the back of their thing that says, play like a Raven. Whether there's, you know, if you listen to Mike Tomlin, Mike Tomlin always says what we always say. The standard is the standard. The standard's been the standard since the 1970s in Pittsburgh. And if you don't live to that standard, you don't play to that standard, you get cut. That's just the way it is. And now it's the same way in Baltimore. So if you don't play like a Raven in Baltimore, if you don't play with that standard, you're going to get cut. You're not going to be a Raven. So that's why when you see the two teams play each other, they're always really good games. They always come down to the last series because they have that same environment inside the building.
Yeah, I remember Ray telling me around one of the London games, the same way we worked together a few years back, Ray was telling me that players in Baltimore, the leaders start policing themselves. So if a young guy comes in the locker room, his underwear's showing because his pants are hanging halfway down, Ray's going to tell him, pull your pants up. And that's culture, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. It's absolutely culture. And it's taking ownership, you know, making sure everybody's on time. And not being on time in the sense that if the meeting starts at 7 o'clock in the morning, that you get there at 7 o'clock. No, you get there at 6:50. Because if you get there at 7, you still got to sit down, you still got to open up your books, you still got to get your pencils out. You're late. You're making everybody wait on you because you're selfish. So that was the environment in Pittsburgh, and that's the environment in Baltimore now. And, you know, I was very fortunate to go to Pittsburgh and learn that culture. And then I was honored to give that culture to Baltimore. And then Ray just took that culture and made it his own and made it the Raven way.
How scary was that 2000 defense?
Oh, we were good, man. We were good. You know, it's the great thing about it. Yeah, the great thing about it is Marvin Lewis became a great defensive coordinator. He really did. I mean, I knew Marvin when he was a rookie green linebacker coach in Pittsburgh, still trying to figure out this whole NFL thing. And Greg Lloyd and Kevin Green and Chad Brown and LeVon Kirkland cussing him out all the time, giving him a hard time. And I'm like, guys, leave him alone. He's going to be a really good coach. Just leave him alone. And, you know, he that year really came into his own in play calling. All the game plans were great game plans. We knew that you're not going to be able to run the ball against us. It just wasn't going to happen. I mean, big Tony Siragusa and Sam Adams, you're not going to run the ball against us. And then our linebacking core, when you talk about Ray Lewis and Peter Bowyer and Jamie Sharper, they were you know, on target. They can run from sideline to sideline. And then we had a young secondary. You know, we drafted Chris McAllister that year. We had Dwayne Starks the year before that. You had me. I moved to safety. You had Kim Herrings and Corey Harris. They were the safeties that kind of like went back and forth and playing on the field. But when Ray really took over his leadership role in the sense of policing everybody, saying, you know, chastising people when he had to and get on guys, because I was kind of like Uncle Rod, because I was the oldest guy in the room. I was the oldest defensive player by far. And Ray was their contemporary. And that's what I told Ray. I'm not going to come here. I'm not here to be a leader. I'm here to help you get your voice. And going into that third year, he got his voice into practice. He started challenging everybody. He started telling people when they were lacking. He started praising them, though, also. And then he became the leader. And then when he became the leader, that's when we blossomed. And that's that third year. And that's when we were really good. And to be honest, when we went to that Super Bowl that year, and we didn't want to play Minnesota because they were really good. But when we watched the film on the New York Giants, we told ourselves they won't get past the 50-yard line on our defense. And they didn't. They only got past once.
From Super Bowl disappointment with the Steelers and to chasing rings, as Rod puts it, with the 49ers, he would eventually get his hands on the Vince Lombardi trophy with the Ravens at Super Bowl 35.
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, that's what you play for. I mean, you play to be the best at what you do, not individually, as a team. I mean, this is the ultimate team sport. And you have one ball. You have 22 individuals on the field, 11 protecting the ball, and 11 are trying to get the ball. I mean, that's the ultimate team sport. So getting that victory, you know, it was such a, you know, the game wasn't really close. So into the third quarter, we knew we were going to win. So we were on the sideline figuring out, you know, what our rings are going to look like and just, you know, talking about the, you know, the parade and how it's going to feel just to be the reigning Super Bowl champs and take that Lombardi trophy to Baltimore.
Right in the middle of your career with Pittsburgh, you kind of mentioned Plan B there a little bit earlier. You were one of the key drivers towards unrestricted free agency that players enjoy today, weren't you? Is that correct?
I was. So it was, I mean, Reggie took the limelight because he signed that huge deal once we did get free agency. But, you know, we had, it was probably, I think, five of us that were named plaintiffs in that litigation. Because I was a free agent twice and I couldn't move. I didn't go anywhere, you know, and Reggie, I think Reggie was three times. So Reggie he was the name plaintiff. We were underneath that, but we all fought, you know. Obviously the players who come before us do lay a path. You know, talking to, you know, Dick LeBeau and those guys and Lem Barney and all those guys who played with Night Train Lane, that they had to work in the off season. You know, they didn't make a lot of money. They had to work in the offseason to make a living, to make ends meet throughout the whole year. You know, we come in, we're making a little bit more money. You know, and our biggest argument was not having freedom of choice. You know, if only one team can draft you and you have to play for that team for your whole life, that's unfair. No other profession in the world had that at that time. So we wanted to fight against that. And once we got it, nobody knew it was going to get like it is today. I mean, nobody knew that the TV deals and the free agency was going to get to this point, but that's what we fought for. We fought for having that free agency, and we decertified from our union because you couldn't sue as a union. So we decertified, became an association, and we still did, you know, still the NFLPA. So we wanted what was right, and that's what we fought for.
Now, hearing Rod describe his efforts to bring more freedom to players and to be a pioneer for free agency, it makes me wonder just how many of them know what he has done for them. Former pros such as Rod have helped deliver the big contracts we see in the NFL today. But do any of the current players recognize him for it?
They don't know. Most of these guys aren't even really educated on the great players of the past. So like Marion Motley and Night Train Lane, and they just don't know, you know, Sammy Ball. They don't even know those names, which is really kind of disappointing. But, you know, one thing that for me, I've always respected the game. I learned the game. I learned who they were. And honestly, I really start learning about them when I have five kids. I have two boys, and my boys start playing Madden. Well, in the backside of Madden, you can make your own teams with the great players of the past. And my son was playing, I think he was probably like 4 or 5. He was like, "Dad, I want to play with, who was playing? I think Peyton was young. Peyton was really, he just came into the league. And he was like, "I want Peyton, my starting quarterback." And I'm like, no, let me look at him. And then I saw all the quarterbacks, and I saw Sammy Ball. And I'm like, dude, you're playing. No, Sammy Ball is your starting quarterback. That's who your starting quarterback is. And then he started learning the names along with me. But when I started looking throughout all of them, then I started looking them up. Like, Marion Motley, that dude was huge for his size. Yeah. Playing back in the day like that. I mean, he was before his time. So all those players that you know, who pay the way for us as athletes, you got to give homage to.
So how did that make you feel when you became a coach? On the one hand, was it great to be still around the game and still on the field and smelling the grass every training camp? Or on the other hand, did you get frustrated at players who didn't take it as seriously as you did, didn't have that same DNA you talked about, maybe didn't respect the past? You know, maybe it's a different type of player. Do you see what I mean? There may be two different things there when you coached.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was frustrated with my players. And not just because, you know, because it's there. It's you're always looking for a pro's pro. And we did have a couple guys who came through the Raiders that were pros pro. Didn't have to ask them to do anything. They did what they were supposed to do. They knew the defense, everything, the little things we told them to do. You know, if we're going to say, "Hey, we're going to play cover two against the Washington Redskins," the first time we play cover two, I want you to play 8 yards off, because especially if you got two receivers on your side, because they're always going to run out by number two. I want you to jump that. But they won't run the out if you're already rolled up. But if you're played off, they're going to run you out. So little things like that you talk about, that you go over throughout the whole week, and then the first time they comes out and it's a perfect call and he rolls up. And I'm like, "I told you not to roll up." So little things like that frustrated me as a coach, because it's coach's job to give you the information. It's your job to use that information as a player. So I blame them, because I'm like, I gave the information. Just like the coaches in my past gave me the information. Obviously, it does take some getting used to take all that information given to you in a 10-second window from the time we break the huddle to the time you see the offense come out to say, "Oh, yeah, this is what I'm going to do." And it has to happen that fast. Some guys can do it. Some guys cannot. I think the great ones find a way to use that, like what Chuck Noll told me to do, be 2-to-1 mental to physical. Because everybody physically gifted in the National Football League, it's the best of the best of the best playing the National Football League. But the greats of the National Football Leagues think as a coach on the field in the process of that little 10-second window.
You had obviously more than 70 interceptions. You set an NFL record for fumble recoveries. I thought those two things really stood out for you as a player. Does that go back to being a safety? Again, do you think those numbers are a result of physical skills or being able to read the game, or is it hustle? Or I guess it's probably a bit of everything.
A combination of everything, but hustle. Get to the ball. Good things happen when you get to the ball. We always, what we used to say in Pittsburgh, and what we started saying when I was in Baltimore, we're going to have a party at the ball. Everybody get to the ball, we have a party. Because if they throw the ball to the flat, and it's Marshall Faulk, and I'm coming on the outside, Greg Lloyd's coming from the inside, and Cardinal Lake's coming from the safety position, he got a choice to make. Like, where are you going to go? Like, you either going to step out of bounds or you're going to get hit. And that's how we played. And we just kept playing and playing and playing. And we just kept saying, and what we always said in Baltimore, more than we said in Pittsburgh, is that pressure or bust a pipe. And if you keep putting pressure on a player and a pressure on a quarterback and a pressure on a receiver and a pressure on a running back, he's eventually going to cough the thing up. And if you're around it, if you don't run to the ball, you can't get it. That's what my, that's our thing. Is like, you got to run to the ball. And if you run to the ball, good things happen. What we used to say when I was in Oakland as a coach, tips and overthrows, got to get those. But the only way you can get to those is run to the ball. So, you know, you make that emphasis to the players. That was kind of ingrained in me, though, because I was, you know, as a Steeler, we had to run to the ball. Like, if we didn't run to the ball, Chuck Noll wasn't going to play you.
Right.
So, yeah, I learned in my first 5 years, it's nothing running to the ball. You just train yourself to do it, and you always do it. And so I think a combination of just hustling all weekend to the ball and just trying to get to the ball once it's on the ground.
Last one, I've walked into that lobby in Pittsburgh, and as you walk in, there are all the Super Bowl trophies. They, you know, it's all there. The history of that great club is laid out before you. And you would have walked in there as a young player. And like you said, you had to take a big step up to the NFL. So going from that to being a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and then, of course, last year to being named to the 100th anniversary team. So your name is etched in NFL history. What's the, when you think about from there to those achievements, what did that mean to you?
I mean, it's, first of all, getting drafted. I'm a country boy from Indiana. My dad was a blue-collar worker, worked in a factory. My mother was the same. You know, to get drafted in the National Football League, got to play 17 years. And to, you know, really become one of the better players who ever don a uniform in the NFL is a blessing. I'm humble. You know, it's an old saying that Dick LeBeau used to say all the time, I'd rather be a has-been than I never was. So I'm glad people remember me. You know, I don't take it too seriously if they don't. You know, some guys do. Some guys get offended. I don't. It's like, listen, some people pay attention to football. Some people don't.
Right.
If you remember me, that's great. If you don't, hey, I don't. It doesn't bother me. I mean, but honestly, I think my biggest accomplishment was in my year 7 when I was named to the 75th anniversary team. Because that was in mid-season. That was like in the middle of my career.
Right.
I was only year 7 for me. I thought the reporters were playing with me because they were like, hey, congratulations, you made the 75th anniversary team. And I'm like, get the frick out of here. You guys are kidding. Stop. And I'm like, I'm walking away from the reporters. Like, I'm literally walking away like, you guys, I don't play that game. I'm not doing that. You're going to hurt my feelings. And then Mr. Rooney walked in. And then when he walked in, he said, congratulations. That's when I said, are you serious? I've only played 7 years. Why did they pick me? Like, did they make a mistake? I think they made a mistake. There must be another Woodson playing somewhere along the line. But that was my biglish. To me, that was just like something that really stood out in my career because I didn't think I really deserved it at that point. But maybe they were projecting. I don't know. That's what they were doing.
So there you are. That's my conversation with Hall of Fame defensive back Rod Woodson. I hope you enjoyed that. It was a lot of fun to catch up with him. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes for the final mailbag of 2020.
Neil! I'm doing my Johnny Hecker impression.
It's terrible.
Every mailbag now, Neil.
Brilliant. I like it. I like the enthusiasm. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Getting into that Christmas spirit.
Oh, yeah, clearly sounds like it. Getting into those Christmas bottles of Bailey's or something.
Oh, yeah, I'm on my third mulled wine for the day.
Yeah, bit of sherry. Lovely.
The edit comes out properly, don't blame me.
No, what we got on the mailbag?
Right, so as it is Christmas, I'm doing you a favour. We've only got two this week.
Oh, yes, not fairly.
But one of them's going to require a lot of effort on your part to answer, I think. It comes from Lucas Mass on Twitter. And he says, have the Chiefs got it in them to dominate like the 49ers did in the 80s and 90s and the Pats in the 2000s and 10s? What do you see as being pivotal for them to be able to create longevity in their obvious superiority other than keeping Mahomes, Kelce and Hill happy? Can you see them dominating for a decade or more? And if so, how?
All right. First of all, it's Kelce, not Kelce, but this is good to educate you.
I was like, I'm going to get this right.
It's good to educate you as we go along. look, the things that those two teams had, the 49ers and the Patriots had, was a franchise quarterback who at the time was considered the best in their field. So it was Joe Montana for the 49ers and obviously Tom Brady for the Patriots. So you can't overlook Patrick Mahomes. He is going to be the factor, the number one factor in them being there year in and year out. And I do think we're going to see in the next decade, the Chiefs win 2-3 more Super Bowls. I think they're that good. And I think if I'm going to take it outside of Mahomes, then I would say the biggest reason is, or biggest two reasons. Number one is retention and consistency. I think they do a great job of keeping their star players, keeping their core players, re-signing their players. That's why Kelce re-signed, Tyreek Hill, Chris Jones on the defensive line. You had Sammy Watkins actually take a pay cut, the wide receiver, to stay with the Chiefs because he knows where his bread's buttered. And I think that's one thing, is that retention. And I think the creativity of Andy Reid as an offensive-minded coach. I think he creates new ways to attack defenses week in and week out and year in and year out. And he's so open to kind of offensive creativity that he actually welcomes kind of players drawing up and scribbling up plays on pieces of paper and bringing them to him. So Mahomes is the number one factor. And then I'd say it's that retention and Andy Reid, but the Chiefs are not going anywhere for quite some time.
Okay, that's an interesting answer. Let's see what happens. Right, last question of the year. The honour goes to Ryan Meppam, also from Twitter. He says, "Hi Neil, how did you first get into the NFL and what made you choose the Dolphins?"
So my dad was a big fan. I think I've mentioned this a couple of times before. My dad was a fan. Tried to get me watching. I wasn't that fussed to begin with. Then I kind of started watching a little bit each week when the old highlights were on Channel 4. And the Dolphins was all about Dan Marino. Dan Marino was a rookie in 1983, kind of around the time I started watching. So I think that excitement that was around him and the way he took the league by storm in the first 2 or 3 years of his career kind of really ignited my passion for the game. And then it just went from there. It just blossomed and ballooned and became kind of all consuming. So, Dan Marino, which is ironic because for so many years afterwards, the Dolphins didn't have a quarterback after he retired and had quite a few down years. So, just loved everything about the sport once I actually learned the rules. The excitement of it was different from anything we had before. Was kind of hooked. And, a lifetime's work has followed.
And you're a big fan of Dan Marino. What was your favourite Dan Marino performance?
Ooh, crikey. That's a good one. I think there was a season, I'm not very good with remembering my seasons. 94 season, I'm going to guess. So at the end of 93, I think he it was either 92 and then into 93 or 93 into 94. He tore his Achilles, so he was out for the previous season. And he came back in the season opener against the New England Patriots. Everyone was worried about, Dan Marino being able to move around and throw the ball. And he threw 5 touchdown passes. I think Irvin Fryer had a couple of big ones. That was one game. And then he beat the New York Jets, Gary, on a game where Miami were hurrying to the line. People will know this game famously. Hurrying to the line late on. With just seconds remaining, a couple of seconds remaining. I don't know if you've seen this, Gary, where the quarterbacks will run up to the line if they're out of timeouts and just spike the ball into the ground to stop the clock.
Right.
Have you seen that?
No, yep. I haven't seen that, but I'll look out for this.
Yep. So they spike the ball into the ground to stop the clock. So all the players are kind of just standing around. And Marino pretends to spike the ball into the ground. And the Jets are all just standing there waiting for him to spike the ball into the ground. And he just pretends to spike it, sets up and throws a touchdown pass to Mark Ingram, which is fantastic, just to completely fool the New York Jets.
Right, so that question from me was just to be facetious because I was going to say to you, remember when you did the interview with Greg Jennings about 6 weeks ago and I said to Greg at the end, I goes, Greg, you're talking about Brett Favre and you missed out. There's something about Mary. And all I was going to say is my favourite Dan Marino performance is in Ace Ventura.
Well, the Dolphins
and then you
won
get
the Super
this educated
Bowl,
response, and I was like, oh, I feel like a right jerk now.
The Dolphins won the Super Bowl in Ace Ventura. They beat the Philadelphia Eagles, so that should have been my favourite moment, but it wasn't.
See, that's just what a moron I am. I always have to bring it back to the movie.
That's a perfect place, with you admitting you're a moron, is the perfect place to end this last episode before Christmas. So just to let everyone know, next week, we're going to put out, because our production crew is going to take a bit of time off. I'm going to take a bit of time off. We're going to put out a best of 2020. So myself and Gary are going to pick out some of our favourite interviews from the series so far. Relive a couple of the stories in that, which are fantastic, of course. So I hope you enjoy that. And then we'll be back. We'll have a bye week, and then we'll be back with a fresh episode all the way through the playoffs, through the Super Bowl on January the 12th. So all that remains for me to say, Gary, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Neil, and everyone else listening.
Yeah, absolutely. To all our listeners, we appreciate the support. Obviously, it's been a very, very difficult year for everybody. So please stay safe. Enjoy your time with your families. Have a very Merry Christmas, and we'll speak to you in the new year. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.